I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. On the show today, we hear from an African-American pastor who chose to bypass the predominantly black weekend rally in Washington led by the Reverend Al Sharpton in favor of the predominantly white rally led by Fox News talk show icon Glenn Beck. That's in a few minutes. But first, a deadly summer in Miami. In July and August, police have shot and killed four African-American men. Law enforcement officials have defended the actions, but the shootings have reinforced long-held distrust of the police in Miami's black neighborhoods. Here to talk about it, we're joined by Miguel Esposito. He's the police chief of Miami, and also with us is Carl Johnson, the pastor of that city's 93rd Street Baptist Church. Both speak to us from the studios of member station WLRN in Miami. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chief, let me start with you. What's the status of the investigation into these shootings? And tell us a little bit about the circumstances, please.
Before I get into that, there was a comment that you made beginning the show, and I think we need to set it straight. This summer has been no more violent than previous summers. I can't get into too much details of the police shootings. We've had four police shootings this year, and we had one that was a result of a traffic stop. And that's the most controversial, only because the gentleman apparently was not armed at the time. The other three shootings, the subjects that were shot, were all armed.
Chief, I wonder, how do you respond to the perception that these shootings are racially motivated?
My response is the African-American community has asked that we go in there and take care of the crime problem, and we've done that. We started some new programs within the police department so that we could respond to their needs in the community. And as a result of that, we've had some confrontations with people that are violent, people that are armed, and that's what has really created this situation. As I've mentioned in the other media, the suspect dictates the outcome of the encounter. And I'll give you as an example, the last shooting, we had two individuals that were armed. One of them was shot by police and killed. The second individual was taken into custody and the weapon was recovered. Why wasn't he shot? Because he did not pose a threat at the time that the police came up to him. He dropped the weapon and there was no threat. The other individual apparently chose another route, and as a result of that, he was shot and killed.
Pastor, let me bring you into the conversation with a question.
Most definitely.
I am from Chicago. I've worked in New York City, and it sometimes seems that when black people are shot by police, the African-American community often assumes it is racially motivated. Do you think at all that's what's happening here, or are you hearing something different from people there?
Well, your statement is correct. That's a natural response when these type of incidents take place. Therefore, when that does happen, the clergy, such as myself, needs to get involved to bring balance and peace and put a corrective action in place. And then you'll see things begin to dwindle and get better. You know, I've done this 10 years ago. I've seen this same behavior taking place, amen, when we had high crime in 2000. And we also got involved in the community and crime went down. So now, since there's been four killings within 6 weeks, I mean, now there's an unrest now. There's an unsettledness now. And then there's a perception out there that the police are killing blacks now. And then the police feel that they're justified. Well, I'm not here to judge the chief. I'm not here to verify or support what the African-American community is saying. I need to come in as a clergy to bring some balance and some corrective action to try to avoid what is the perception. And that's my response to you.
Pastor, let me ask you, are people in the community, I mean, obviously there's been some crime here. Are they afraid now? And are they more afraid of the police than of the crime that's, I guess, been leading to these shootings, allegedly?
I would say so, ma'am. I would say based on me communicating with parents and also some of the parishioners of my church, there is not only a fear, but there's also a ungratefulness about the police department. So when that takes place,
and ungratefulness. And you have parishioners,
yeah, ungratefulness. I use that word and I use it emphatically because the police department, they're supposed to make sure they look after the citizens of our city. And whenever the citizens, I'm talking about the citizen, legitimate citizen who are not infiltrating crime, whenever they feel uneasiness, then there is not a gratefulness about the police department. And so we ought to be grateful that we have police departments that are doing the right thing, bringing peace and bringing crime down. But when you feel there's an unsettledness and an unrest going on in the community, that gratefulness is not there. I'm grateful that we have police departments. I'm grateful that we have good police. But when that perception is going another way, then I become concerned and the gratefulness is not there. And I'm concerned for the community, and I'm also concerned for the cops.
Hang on just a second, Pastor. If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes. We're talking about a series of fatal shootings by Miami police officers. Our guests are Miami Police Chief Miguel Exposito and Pastor Carl Johnson of the city's 93rd Street Baptist Church. Chief, I wonder, some of the critics have suggested that the reason for some of these shootings, or perhaps one of the reasons for them, is that there is a department-wide attitude in these neighborhoods that's more confrontational than cooperative. What do you think about that perception?
From my perspective, the reason why we're having these shootings is because we have a small part of that community that's involved in criminal activity. They've been involved in this for several years. One of the most violent situations occurred last year, July of 2009, where we had 12 people injured by gunfire, and 2 people were killed in one party. There was a party, and this person opened up on the crowd with an AK-47. As a police department, you can't allow that to continue. And I'm only giving you an example. We also had other shootings. In one, 7 people were injured and 2 people were killed. So, we have to do what we need to do from our perspective to make the citizens in that area feel safe. It's no different than in the 80s when you had primarily Hispanics involved in that type of activity, when we had the Cocaine Cowboys in Miami. At that time, we also had a lot of police shootings. In this case, the people that were being killed were Hispanics primarily.
Pastor, in the 90s, there was the time where members of the clergy were riding along with officers in some of the communities. You've suggested doing this again. What makes you think it'll work in this environment?
Well, this corrective action, I know it has to work, ma'am, because of the fact that when this unrest began to occur, I went to the commissioner, and the chief consensually endorsed this vision. He's here today, and he's supporting the vision that, number one, Pastor, I agree with you, in order to curtail this so-called confrontation that the police is giving out in the community. I agree with your vision, Pastor Johnson. Let the pastors ride with the police, and let the parents call in to the pastors what the problems are at, and let the pastors get out of the police car and just talk, get them saved, get them delivered, get them to be the see the light. And so look how that would help them. Instead of being killed to go, we call to a place called hell because they got crime in their heart. If we can reach them first and then get them changed, and then if they have to go through the system, through the prison system, because they commit the crime, then so be it, because that's the way the law of the land is.
Really briefly, and let me ask you both, do you think that the ride-alongs and the cooperation between the clergy and the officer will help calm some of the tensions between police there and the African-American community? And Chief, let me ask you to answer first.
I certainly believe that it will. This is all about finding solutions, and this is a solution. It's worked in the past, and there's no reason to believe that it will not work now.
Pastor Johnson?
Yes, ma'am. May I strongly consensually endorse what the chief said. Based on past corrective practices, it worked in the past. We're at it again. The good thing about it is the chief is willing to endorse this plan, and the clergy is willing to work the plan. There is no question, and I emphatically said it will work.
Chief, a question about the ride-alongs. If there's clergy with you and you have to go into, basically a crime scene or into harm's way, is that going to be feasible for both the officer and the clergyman involved?
We have a ride-along program that involves civilian people that want to ride with us, and we obviously will do everything possible to make sure that they do not get hurt in any way. This would be no different than having one of our citizens wanting to do a ride-along.
Right. And our mindset as clergy, we're not actually one who wants to go into the actual crime scene while it's going on. We want to get there before the crime scene occur. We are looking to ride with the police to go out there to what we believe problem areas that the parents are asking us to go out and visit, and also places that we deem needs to be corrected. So we're looking at it to become a proactive approach before it gets to become a crime scene. So we're not riding in when there's a crime scene going on. We're going in before the crime scene to curtail and stop the crime.
Pastor, one brief question.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I know young people in Southwest Washington, where I am, are a little, shall we say, have some problems with authority. So
yes.
I'm just curious, you really think they're going to pay attention to what the pastors are saying, or they're not just going to continue doing what they're doing and say so rudely?
I must say, to speak for myself, in the first plan, when the crime was up, many of the so-called drug dealers and the young, strong, crazy, chaotic people joined my church and joined many churches. The respect level of the clergy here is good.
And you don't think in a climate that may be more violent? I mean, kids have been playing the video games. They're more inured to violence,
okay.
I think, now.
Yeah. And my son, I have a 18-year-old son, and he shared that dynamic with me. But he also believes in his father that even though there's more hostility going on with those videos destroying the mindset of some of my young people, he believes in the God in me and the God we serve that can deal with that dynamic. So, yes, ma'am, I still believe it can work, because whatever the mindset is, whether it's more chaotic or crazy, we have a greater God to deal with that. And we carry that God with us out on the street. So we got it under control. I believe so.
Carl Johnson is pastor of the 93rd Street Baptist Church in Miami, and Miguel Exposito is the police chief of Miami. They both joined us from member station WLRN in Miami. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Allison.
I'm Allison Keyes. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. 5 years ago today, much of New Orleans was underwater. More than 1 million people were displaced by Hurricane Katrina, and some never moved back. We'll hear the tale of a Vietnamese-American family pining for the old neighborhood from its new neighborhood in Houston. But first, it's the tale of two very different rallies this past weekend in Washington. Tens of thousands, maybe more, gathered at the Lincoln Memorial Saturday for an event put together by Fox News Channel talk show host Glenn Beck. He called it Restoring Honor.
Look ahead! Dream about what we're going to become, not worried about what we are. Look forward, look west, look to the heavens, look to God, and make your choice.
While Beck's rally was predominantly white, a much smaller rally in March to the National Mall on the anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s March on Washington speech was predominantly black. Here's Reverend Al Sharpton.
They want to disgrace this day. And we're not giving them this day. This is our day, and we ain't giving it away.
African-American pastor Harry Jackson chose the Beck rally. In fact, he spoke there, and he's with us now in our Washington, D.C. studio. Bishop Jackson, leads a Pentecostal congregation at the Hope Christian Church just outside of Washington, and has also founded what he calls the High Impact Leadership Coalition, which focuses on abortion and same-sex marriage. Welcome, Bishop.
Thank you very much for having me here, Allison.
Let me first ask you, how do you rate Saturday's rally?
I thought it was A+, because they stayed away from politics, largely focused on the moral and social issues.
In other words, there weren't the signs that you've seen at some of the Tea Party-ish rallies over the last...
Exactly. It wasn't really the same group. And up front, there were about 200 ministers in reserve seating. About 60 of those folks were people of color, ranging from... Native Americans onto blacks and Hispanics. And so I believe it was a unifying cry for folks to begin to say, America needs a spiritual answer to some of the problems that we face today.
So you're saying it was a more racially diverse rally than it looked on television?
Only among the leadership. Now, if you walk through the crowd, as I walked away from the platform, I had ovations, people stood up, cheered, but it was because that crowd was largely white. But among the leadership people that, if you were able to see it up close, were really focused on and featured by Beck in terms of their team saying, come out, join us, let's make a difference in America. Those people were very, very diverse. But the majority, 95% of the whole crowd, was white American.
You wrote an article that ran on Friday titled Beck's Rally, What Would MLK Do? And as we've already said, Reverend Sharpton had a simultaneous rally called Reclaim the Dream.
Yep.
But you wrote that the question for the weekend would be, what would Martin Luther King Jr. do about the social ills of our day? What do you think is the answer to that? And of the two factions which rallied, why do you think Beck's more embodies what King's dream was?
Well, let me say that there was, after hearing about Sharpton's, there's real value to what he emphasized when they weren't kind of bashing, or as the kids call it, player hating. but his emphasis on education as a major problem for African Americans is huge. It still creates a lot of the economic gaps that we have in our society. I'm an advocate for the poor. So what I thought Beck brought to the table, contrary to some of the rhetoric that has been part and parcel of how they've talked about the administration and other things.
How they, meaning Beck?
Meaning Beck.
Okay.
Beck specifically, personally, is that he managed to bring together this large group of evangelicals predominantly, working with someone who is a member of the Mormon Church. Is very rare. We've had some partnership with regard to the marriage battle in California, even here in D.C.
And I should quote you, your organization opposes same-sex marriage.
We oppose same-sex marriage. And some Mormon funders have been really instrumental in these social concerns. So I think it was an amazingly unifying event from that perspective of saying there's going to need to be a broad coalition who are going to restore some of the American values in terms of these social concerns. And that's where we were.
I'm interested in that coalition because you've written about it, I should say. Who's in this coalition? What's it look like?
Well, I think it looks like Roman Catholics, black, white, and Hispanic evangelicals, meaning folks who talk about the born-again experience, they're Bible-believing, they have a high regard to what I would call the integrity of Scripture. And you now bring on other groups, such as the Mormons did a huge job in California relative to the funding of that effort to protect marriage. Those folks are concerned about certain things that are, again, on the social order. And I don't think the two rallies should be seen as competing. I think in some ways they may be completing if you take the tendency of both the figureheads to want to play for the headline, if you know what I mean, by incendiary language.
I'm wondering, we were just talking about the racial get-up of both rallies, but it seems to me that many African-Americans think that Glenn Beck holds views that are hostile to black people and to the President Obama. I wonder if you think that some socially conservative blacks might agree with your views morally but be concerned about that dynamic.
Well, I was personally concerned myself, tell you the truth. And if it had not been for Avita King, who is the niece of Martin Luther King Jr., who personally invited me to come, David Barton, who is an amazing historian from a Christian perspective, who does a whole thing about blacks who were involved in the Revolutionary War, and he's got a huge emphasis on what my mother taught me around the kitchen table that doesn't no longer get taught in school, I probably would have stayed away myself. But in talking to the two of them, and I wasn't coerced into this by Beck or his party or his group, rather, they really helped me see what they thought the vision was to come out and let there be an alarm that there has to be engagement of people who have a faith orientation. And, you know, as a revolutionary folk said, we must all hang together or we will all hang separately, was their kind of idea.
I'm curious whether you think that conservative blacks or black people in general, and I've got to ask it briefly, have an issue with the president's policies and with his moral compass, as Glenn Beck has suggested.
I would think that we're mixed. I'm as proud as I can be that President Obama is the first black man to hold that great seat, that the glass ceiling has been broken for African Americans. No longer do my kids have to wonder whether you can be whatever you can be in America. We've got to give it to him for that and for running the most amazing presidential campaign in recent history. Secondly, though, on these issues of marriage, I'm just very concerned at his statements about he would sign a repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act and things along that nature. So there is going to be ambivalence around who he is, who Beck is, and those guys are as it relates to the president.
Bishop, let me ask you really quickly. Will we see you partnering more with Glenn Beck in the future?
You may. The question for me is I want to create a swing vote that African-Americans are not just owned by the Democratic Party.
Okay. Bishop Harry Jackson of the Hope Christian Church, just outside of Washington, and the High Impact Leadership Coalition joined us right here in our studios in Washington, D.C. Thank you, sir, so much for your insights.
Thank you, ma'am.
Now we open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine, something Tell Me More does just about every week to find stories about the way we live now. This week, a story about going home again, in this case, home to New Orleans. For the fifth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, Washington Post staff writer Elan Mui wrote about returning to the Crescent City, her hometown. She joins me now in our Washington studio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with having you read some of this beautiful piece.
I'd love to. I bumped into my past one steamy afternoon in June at a snowball stand just outside of New Orleans. As I pulled into the Shell parking lot in front of Sal's Snowballs, I debated flavors. Watermelon or wedding cake? Should I go for broke and get sweetened condensed milk poured on top, another local specialty? The stand, a little brick house with two walk-up windows and a few big wooden logs serving as seats out front, has been in the same spot for half a century. It even still uses the same ice machine, a small but determined stand against the passage of time.
I was in New Orleans recently for the BP oil spill, and so were you. What's changed there since your last visit?
Well, I think that a lot has changed and a lot has remained the same. I grew up in New Orleans. I was born and raised right outside of the city, and I've been going back almost every year since Katrina. And each time I see a little bit more rebirth, but each time I also see places that haven't entirely been rebuilt yet. And what really struck me when I was down there covering the oil spill, I was down there for about 3 weeks, a really good chunk of time, was that so many of the touchstones that were important to me were still there. And that made me really happy. And I felt that a lot of times around fifth anniversaries, and this was such a devastating hurricane, we think about all the things that are different and all the things that haven't come back. And so I wanted to write about what I felt was still there and why I felt like New Orleans was still the same city that I left.
So yay for the snowballs.
Yay for the snowballs.
What other things were there that you remember that made you think, oh, I'm still at home?
Well, one thing that I was very happy to see was that one of the most popular local bands, Rebirth Brass Band, they play every Tuesday night at the Maple Leaf Bar.
Yes, they do.
Yes, they do. And I used to go there when I was in college. You know, sometimes maybe I was under 21 at times when I tried to get in there. But I went there, and it was so exciting for me to be there. And the atmosphere was so electric, and the band was playing so loudly, and everyone was sort of friends and dancing together. And that, to me, was a real New Orleans moment that still continues to this day.
You grew up in St. Bernard Parish, right outside of New Orleans, right?
Yes, I did.
Your family's home there was flooded. 10 feet of water during the hurricane?
10 feet of water. St. Bernard Parish was one of the areas that was the worst affected areas by the hurricane. Really, the neighborhood has struggled to come back. I was looking at some statistics that showed the population was something like 60,000 before the hurricane, and the year after it was something like 14,000.
Right. Now, they're like big empty spaces as you go down the highway out there.
Yes,
it's really kind of eerie.
There are. There are a lot of vacant lots. And, you know, my family had struggled a lot to get to St. Bernard. They're from Vietnam, and they had to leave everything once when they immigrated to this country, and they built a new life in St. Bernard Parish. And, you know, when the hurricane came and took it all away again, they said, you know, we're not going to risk it. They decided to move to Houston, and they left St. Bernard, but I wanted to find the pieces of myself and my family that were still there.
In your piece, you write a bit about going to see your old home. Could you read a little bit for us?
Sure. I passed my house 3 times before I found the courage to stop and ring the doorbell. When we moved in during my fifth grade year, I was over the moon. The house was 2 full stories with massive columns and a built-in pool. My room upstairs, was all pink, pink floral wallpaper, pink carpet, and pink chandelier. Later, during my rebellious teenage years, I covered the pink with psychedelic posters of the Beatles and stuck glow-in-the-dark stars on this popcorn ceiling with putty. The house sat empty for a few years after the hurricane as my parents dealt with paperwork and tried to find a buyer. In the meantime, looters stripped it of every useful piece of equipment, copper pipes, electrical wire, light fixtures. But on this afternoon in June, the grass was mowed, the front door was repaired, and cars were parked in the driveway. Someone else was living there.
So did you knock on the door?
I did knock on the door.
What happened?
I found that the family that was living there was actually another Vietnamese family and turned out to be friends of my parents. I told them that I had a very strange request and I wanted to look around. They said, "Who's your dad?" And I said, "Well, my dad is Dr. Mui." And he said, "All right, you're good. Come on in." So I came in and I toured the house, and they had completely redone everything because the house had been stripped. And it was a beautiful home, and they're a very, very nice family. So nice for taking me in. But it was also a little hard because it wasn't the house that I had grown up in, and it wasn't the house that I had intended to come back and visit many years later.
So many Vietnamese did go back, actually, after the hurricane. Are you sorry that your parents didn't?
I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, I had already left. You know, I had already made my decision, and this was really something that was their choice. But I do wish that I still had family in New Orleans, because it's not a great feeling to go back to the place that you feel like is home and have to stay in a hotel room.
What's the neighborhood like now? Does it, I mean, besides the places that you remember, is the feeling the same? Is the ambience the same, kind of?
Well, I think that in St. Bernard Parish, it has been a struggle to come back. It's sort of patchy. I found that even just driving down my street, there were several houses that had been rebuilt, but there were a lot of for sale signs, which kind of indicated to me that developers were at work, or some families had rebuilt but decided not to come back to the house that they rebuilt. So that makes it a challenge to find that sense of community that was there previously.
Do you yourself want to move back?
I have grand visions of retiring one day and living in a house in the Garden District with a gin and tonic and a floppy hat on my head and watching life go by. You know, whether or not that will actually happen, we'll have to wait and see.
There is a lot of talk about whether or not New Orleans will emerge as kind of a new city. I mean, I don't know, maybe some less of the character that made it so special. Does it still, when you're walking through it, feel like the place that you grew up in?
I think that your experience of the new New Orleans will depend largely on where you're from and what situation you were found yourself in after the hurricane. So I think that that is one thing to be aware of. But I don't think that the city has lost any of its soul. If anything, I find that the people who are still there are so proud to be there and are so invested in the city in a way that is maybe even stronger than it was before, that I don't think that any bit of New Orleans culture will go away.
I'm curious, what do you think about the way the city is being rebuilt? There's been a lot of talk about whether some neighborhoods are getting more help than others. Does it seem fair to you? Does it seem like the city is committed to bringing it all back?
That is a loaded question. And I actually recently wrote a story about some of the changing racial demographics in the city after Katrina. And we had a story recently also in the newspaper about the city being more affluent than it had been because some of the poor residents didn't have the wherewithal to come back. I think it's really important that New Orleans be diverse. And I think that the people who are there recognize, at least in talking to the locals and talking to residents, they recognize that New Orleans history has always been a mix of many different cultures and a mix of many different income levels and a mix of many different societies. And I think that they're really committed to making sure that that comes back.
Okay. Ilan Mui is a staff writer for The Washington Post. Her story of returning to New Orleans is in this week's Washington Post magazine. If you'd like to read the story, and we hope you will, go to npr.org and go to the Tell Me More page. Thanks, Ilan, for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. In a time that sometimes seems long ago and far away, when African pendants and cries of black consciousness ruled the day on the radio, hip-hop was born. It's a style of music originally devoted to the uplift and education of the masses. It embodied everything from anger to celebration of the neighborhoods of the nation's cities, and it embraced the voices of strong women who had something important to say. Women like Dana Owens, a.k.a. Queen Latifah, heard here in Ladies First.
The ladies will kick it, the rhyme it is wicked. Those that don't know how to be pros get evicted. A woman could bear you, break you, take you. Now it's time to rhyme. Can you relate to a sister dope enough to make you holler and scream?
Hey, yo, let me take it from here, queen.
As the genre gained popularity and drew big money, the queens and homegirls of hip-hop gave way to performers with more overtly sexual images. Rappers like Lil' Kim told critics that change was strictly business because sex sells. But the sex became a formula, forcing some female fans and MCs to choose between the image and the message. Music taste changed, sales dropped, and in 2005, the category of Best Female Rapper was dropped from the Grammy Awards. But the female MCs, like platinum-selling MC and producer Missy Elliott and Grammy-winning performer Lauryn Hill, say don't get it twisted, they're not going anywhere. Documentarian Ava DuVernay presents her film, My Mic Sounds Nice, A Truth About Women and Hip-Hop Tonight on cable channel BET. DuVernay joins us along with another guest, the legendary Grammy-nominated artist, rapper, and entertainer, Lana Michelle Moore, better known as MC Light.
The word ultimate, I'm here to take the title, but I had a little trouble on my rubber, but I got rid of those who tried to rob me. Light is here, no one can stop me. I am the light.
We should note that one of MC Light's diaries is now in a Smithsonian Institution exhibit about hip-hop. Thank you for joining us, ladies.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Ava, I have to say, the documentary seems something like an ode, almost to an era-long past, is it?
Oh, it's a love letter. It's a love letter to the art of the female MC. It's a love letter to women in hip-hop, whether they be DJs or MCs or graffiti artists, dancers, executives even. It's really time that we look at these sisters and give them their due.
Ms. Light, I know you've been around all in this from the beginning. Was hip-hop ever truly equal? In other words, was it ever based strictly on an MC's skills and not on your gender?
Oh, boy, that's an interesting question. I don't believe so. I think it was always your female MC, you know, not just looked upon as just an MC. But you could always, oh, you good for a female MC, though.
Right. But only for a female, not in your own right as an MC who was stepping to it.
Well, yeah. I mean, you can ask a couple of the male MCs and, you know, I sometimes make their list as, you know, one of the 5 to 10 best MCs ever. But I think it's just some very isolated incidences.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, early on, I mean, women were a big part of this battle game. I mean, why did that change? And I would love for Ms. Light to answer first and then Ava.
I don't know that I can agree with that. I think from the beginning, it's always never been enough of us.
Okay.
To this date, I don't believe Def Jam ever held on to 2 at one time. They always switched out. You know, first it was D, then it was The Boss, and then it might have been somewhere in between there, but then came Foxy, and then, you know, so they only did 1 at a time. And that period of time was probably the late 80s to the mid-90s. But we've always been trying to stand our ground and have more on the front line. It's just, you know, opportunities haven't been available.
Ava, what do you think?
Well, I mean, definitely the late 80s to the early 90s, as Light said, was the golden era of hip-hop overall. And definitely during that time you saw, you know, good numbers of women comparatively, about 45 or so women signed to major labels at that time, recording, touring, making music videos on the radio. And there's been a drastic drop-off to the point where we're at 2010, and there are about 3 women signed to major labels at this point. And
so, wow, are there even that many?
There are 3, yeah. 3 signed to major labels, Nicki Minaj, Trina, and a new woman named Diamond, who just signed to Jive. And so,
and what's important to know about both of those is that they may be signed ultimately to a major, but they came by way of an independent. So it's not like that record label taking a big gamble saying, oh, well, we're going to sign this artist. What they're doing is making someone else do the work, and then they're reaping the benefit. So it's not even like it was back in the day being signed to a major artist.
In other words, Light, it's not like they're going out looking for female MCs.
Right.
Do they have any interest? I mean, they're all through the documentary, people were saying women don't sell, women don't sell. I mean, is that really true?
You want to take that, Ava?
Yeah, I mean, that's the answer that all of the executives that we interviewed gave, that the industry changed and ultimately that women didn't sell. I mean, we have examples of women selling, you know, from whether it's Missy, who's the most commercially successful female rap artist of all time, to Lauren, to Foxy and Kim. I mean, there are instances. But the theory that's given is comparatively to their male counterparts, the sales are not robust enough to warrant the money that's spent on grooming promoting, developing, and keeping a female artist out. There are glam squads that they point to, the hair, makeup, and styling, other needs. Some of the women that we interview say that's hogwash. And so that's what the documentary explores, the different reasons, theories behind it. The bottom line is we are where we are. There are very few women on the radio anymore. And so if you want to hear a female MC, you've got to kind of mine the underground. There's some great pearls there, great gems, women that are doing amazing things in that space. But ultimately, they're not in the mainstream.
Ava, I'm going to come back to both the glam and the underground in a second, but I'm curious, who is buying the CDs currently of the three women who are out there on the labels?
Well, Trina is one of the women. She's been out for 12 years. She's a rapper out of the Miami area. She has a very kind of sexual image, and she has a fan base that's largely regional and predominantly male.
Mm-hmm.
This is who she appeals to. And we interview her in the documentary, and she talks about the fact that this was her strategy, that this is how you sell records. You have to be sexy. Men want sexy, and that's what she gives them, and she's been around for 12 years doing just that. There's also Diamond, the new woman. She kind of fits in that mold of a kind of a sexy image. And then, of course, Nicki Minaj, who's kind of the MC of the moment. I think part of the reason why people are turning their attention to the lack of female MCs is the rise of Nicki Minaj,
mm-hmm.
a woman that's incredibly popular right now and basically is kind of standing alone on the airwaves. Her fan base, largely male and very young.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes. We're speaking with documentarian Ava DuVernay about her film, My Mic Sounds Nice, A Truth About Women in Hip Hop, and lyricist and rapper MC Light. Light, you made an interesting point about the power and influence of male rappers who have these scantily clad women in their videos, and that kind of makes it hard for the people that watch those videos to think of women as having the brain to have something to say that they want to listen to.
You know, it's so funny. When you first asked me, the first thing that came to mind, and I wanted to completely keep it music,
mm-hmm.
but I read an article way long ago about Robert Redford was at that time, I think, on a couple of dates and, you know, dating some people, and he dated Jane Fonda.
Mm-hmm.
And Jane Fonda said that Robert Redford told her, it's always great for a woman not to say everything she knows.
Wow.
To show up. That's the history of our life, you know? Like, it's so much better when we just don't speak.
As long as we're wearing red lipstick.
Yeah, and Chuck D said it best. It's like, really, people, what's being sold is like lips and hips and TNA in a bottle. It's like they don't want anything, you know, that has to do with making them look at themselves or correct some things that may be wrong. Or so, yes, to answer your question, it becomes, you know, eye candy and much better to have. And I think, I don't know if I did in the documentary, but I liken it to soul food that leaves the hood. When you're in the mall, most of the seasoning goes out. Like,
right.
You're like, okay, I'm really going to have to travel all the way up to that spot to get the food because it just doesn't taste the same. And that's pretty much where we are with hip-hop in general, and then also that part that involves the female MC is that ever since, you know, Missy, who's innovative, has hit the scene, and she and Timbaland came up with this crazy dance sound. This is for my people, this, you know, it's like, oh my God, this can really happen. Then after that point, it was a whole bunch of people, you know, built on sort of the blueprint that Missy came from, which was, you know, which is Nelly Furtado and Fergie and all the rest of them. So now when a black female hip-hop artist comes out, she has to be able to compete with Gwen Stefani, Fergie, and all of the rest of those pop acts that have somehow merged themselves into the hip-hop world via a hip-hop producer.
So if current rappers like Trina and Nicki Minaj are embracing that very sexual image, aren't they kind of buying into that program?
I think what they're doing, and not just them, but the new MC, is realizing this is a business. Like, it's become a business. And you will have, with the corporate structure, you have people who deal with business all day. And then you have people who are grassroots who are showing up at the YMCA and the Girls and Boys Club. It's two different mindsets. So in hip-hop, you have people that look at it as a business. Trina is very right to say. That's what men like. I mean, that's what a lot of our hip-hop magazines, it's no longer Word Up or Rap Masters. It's these other hip-hop magazines that cater to just that. They have automobiles, they have women who have barely anything on, and they have men talking about hip-hop. Like, so female MCs are, women are not buying female MC hip-hop. Mm-hmm. I don't believe they are, because there's nothing for them to grasp onto.
Ava, let's take a listen to Lauryn Hill. People in your documentary had a lot to say about her.
The second verse is dedicated to the man. All concerned with his rims and his Timbs and his women. Him and his men. Come in the club like hooligans. Don't care who they your fan. Poppy Yang.
Like you got yang.
Let's not pretend. The one to pack pissed out by the waist, man. Crissed out by the casement. Still the name of this basement. The pretty face man. Claiming that they did a bid, man. Need to take care of their 3 or 4 kids.
You know, a lot of people in the documentary, Ava, talked about Lauryn Hill as if she left and took the entire female talent in hip-hop with her. Although you've just said that there are some current women on the underground. But is that overreaching her influence?
I know. It was so strange. As I asked the questions about Lauryn and I went back and looked at the footage, every single person that we interviewed spoke about her in the past tense. Lauryn was this. She was beautiful. She was the jewel of hip-hop. She was, you know, and really, as we put the footage together, it's an emotional part of the film to kind of talk about her legacy and just the emotion that she evokes when you say her name. We interviewed 35 people, and literally every single one went into their own world, and their eyes glaze over when they talk about Lauryn. And, you know, that's the question. I mean, she does leave the game. She stops actively recording, performing, and appearing. And, you know, the question is, did that signal the kind of turning away of that kind of music and the embracing of the more hypersexual image? I mean, was her departure the cause for the industry to say, you know what, she was the only one that could do that. She's gone. Let's embrace what's left. And so that all of those arguments are what we present there. The interesting thing is I just flew up to San Francisco and saw Lauryn at Rock the Bells. Mm-hmm. She performed a very rare performance in San Francisco last weekend and literally blew the roof off of the place.
Like, I actually want to go back to something that you did that always made me love you from the beginning, because you were one of the first female MCs that called out all of the boys for their crudeness and their violence. What was it made you say, you know what, I'm doing my thing, but I have to say that this is not cool?
I was insulted. Like, really, I think for a long time, and I even watched an interview that I did with Arsenio Hall, and he said, well, you know, how do you feel about the B word? And I was like, well, they're not talking to me. And years later, yeah, no, they are. They are talking to me. They're talking to all of us, because I am my sister, and my sister is me. So my perspective is very different from then. But also, I just remember the first time I was in an L.A. club and I heard a song that had, you know, B, 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 and it was by Snoop Dogg. And I walked over to the DJ and I was like, what is this? And he told me, and I was like, can you change it? Because I'm offended right now. And he did. But we're a long way from there. You know, it's kind of become the norm.
What do you think, Light, about Snoop and some of the male rap that is out there? Is it still as insulting as it was in the past? Has it mitigated at all?
I think we've become somewhat numb to it, you know, because I can't say when Drop It Like It's Hot comes on that I scurry from the dance floor. I'm still there, you know. And part of it is the music. The music is incredible, and I think we've learned to sort of like not pay attention to the words. And that's what hip-hop is missing. Like, Drake stepped on the scene, is making so much noise because you can actually hear what he's saying. He's not hiding behind a beat, but he wants you to, like, listen and understand that he actually has thoughts that sort of merge together. It's not like these sporadic, you know, line after line, and then at the end you're like, what did he just say, or what did I just hear?
Mm-hmm.
I feel somewhat disappointed still in what I hear.
Ava, what do you think? Is there music out there now that doesn't offend you to listen to?
Well, there's an incredible woman named Ty Phoenix, and she has an album called Half Woman, Half Amazing, which is amazing.
Yo, subliminal, I played you like my Fender Rose. It's commendable, I'm lending hope and making women dough.
You like to talk trash, you need to fall back. You get your jaw crack, right here.
There's a woman named Medusa in Los Angeles. Tons of great music out.
License plate got a Cali frame. Rep LA with breast cone slang. Don't mean that I bang. I gotta bang, my beats is banging. License plate got a Cali frame.
There's a woman, actually a white woman, out of Detroit. Her name is Invincible Detroit. She is incredible.
Really?
Oh my gosh, she makes your head spin.
Man, I hate hate, but I hate bigots, especially the ones who make 8 digits. His maid underpaid, and while she's making a steak dinner on the rim of the tears, he wonders why the taste bitter. Caught the itis, heavy eyelids, sink too deep to wake him, in his dream state, cleans plates, and his feet are aching.
They're out there. I hope people kind of watch the doc, pick up some names, go on iTunes, Google these women. You know, they've all got Facebooks. They're all very social media savvy. Their music is readily available. There's really no excuse. If you say that you miss women in hip-hop, we're telling you they're there. If you really miss them, go support them and, you know, help their voices be heard.
Ava DuVernay's documentary, My Mic Sounds Nice, A Truth About Women in Hip-Hop, airs on BET tonight. She joined us from our studios at NPR West. Lyricist and rapper MC Light joined us from Los Angeles. Thank you, ladies, very much.
Thank you.
And I'll bet that I did it. My fingerprints are still on you. How many times I gotta warn you about the light? It'll blind your sight, but the rhythm will still guide you through the night.
And that's our show for today. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keys. Let's talk more tomorrow. Kick this.